Our topic today that brought you in here was the topic of alternatives to feminism. Of course, maybe it was the food that brought you in here. That's pretty typical for a Federalist Society event. If there were no food, there would be no event, I think. It's probably safe to say most of the time. But I have a prepared speech here, but I think I won't read the whole prepared speech. I think what I'll do is just talk with you about the state of feminism, or this term, this word feminism, and then talk about what I think is a good approach going forward. Because I have given a lot of talks related to feminism on a lot of different campuses, and one of the things I've noticed is that the word means a lot of different things to different people. And so let's start by kind of clarifying what we're talking about. What is this phenomenon of feminism that we're talking about? I think it's safe to say that the original meaning of the term feminism came from sort of two sources in the 1960s. One is obviously coming from Betty Friedan's work, The Feminine Mystique, and then secondly coming from the formation of the National Organization for Women. Those were kind of the watershed events that defined the beginning of the feminist movement as it was typically understood. And those two events, in my view, turned the women's movement, let's use the women's movement to encompass the more broad issue here. Those two events drove the women's movement into a very particular direction, which I believe has been destructive in many respects, and that's what we want to deal with, is the destructive features of that. And what I believe happened is that in the 1960s, there were apparent several trends in the labor market and in higher education, which the women's movement of that time, the feminist movement, more or less piggybacked on and drove them into a very particular ideological direction. Now, what I'd like to start with is two points. First of all, I want to say that I think most people who are concerned with feminism or who think of themselves as feminism, the broadest objective that people have, I think, the thing that brings people in, the things that people find the most appealing or attractive about feminism is the idea that women should have careers, that women should participate in higher education, but women should be involved in public life on approximately the same terms as men. That is the appeal, that's what people want, that's what people like. And the early incarnation of feminism, and indeed the whole argument over feminism, had to do with bringing people in on terms that were equal. And the whole argument had to do with what are we talking about when we say equal? In what dimensions do we mean equality? And I think that what has happened is that at this particular point in time, the old school type of feminism, there really is an old school feminism. There really is an establishment kind of feminism, which is kind of finished in a way. And you can see that in the recent comments from some of the feminist establishment leaders over the stimulus package, over the bailout bill, whatever you want to call it, whatever you want to call this budgetary monstrosity that's going on up on the Hill. One hesitates to call it a stimulus package. I'm not sure what it's stimulating exactly. But one of the complaints about it was there's not enough jobs for women in the stimulus package. They're not creating enough jobs for women. And you look at that and you think, who cares? What is this about? Particularly since about 80% of the jobs lost have been male jobs, jobs in construction and industries of that kind. Most of the people who've lost jobs actually have been men. When you analyze the data of where the jobs are likely to be created, it's probably 40% of the jobs in that stimulus package are going to turn out to be female jobs. So it's already tilted towards women, if in fact your objective was to stimulate the economy. But never mind. The old school establishment feminist, retired law professor Linda Hirschman, came out with this big complaint that somehow the stimulus package wasn't doing enough to help women. So that's on the left-wing side. They're thinking, you know, we have to somehow make it we're going to put women out there as our Trojan horse, which we'll use to bring in whatever other package we want, whatever objective we want. You know, that's one way of looking at feminism. On the other side, just had a conversation not too long ago with some women who are active in the conservative movement, saying that their boss is interested in breaking the glass ceiling for women in leadership within the conservative movement, within politics generally. And these two women, who are about your age, who were talking to me, were saying, what is wrong with her that she's talking like that? There's no glass ceiling. We don't care about the glass ceiling. We think the glass ceiling's over. We're not that worried about whether the first woman president is conservative or liberal because she's a woman or not a woman. That's not what we're concerned about. the bigger concern for women our age, this is what they're telling me, the bigger concern for us is how are we going to live our lives in a way that allows us to use our educations and our talent, and at the same time allows us to have a reasonable home life and family life, that allows us to get married at a reasonable age, have some kids, enjoy those kids, stay married, and still have a stable and productive career path. That's what younger women are more interested in. That's what, so both from the right and from the left, there's a kind of, you know, a way where a lot of the women in who are in their now in their 50s and 60s are kind of thinking in this, you know, kind of fighting the last war with each other. And my sense is that younger women are looking for something a little bit different from some of those earlier battles. So what I want to do is just put this in a little bit of historical perspective for you. To first of all, I want to mention the educational and labor force trends that have been in place for a long time, and which I believe the feminists of the 60s hijacked in a certain way and steered the movement in a particular direction. So let me just quote to you a few statistics. Although the fact is not widely known, the ratio of male to female undergraduates in the United States was about at parity from 1900 through 1930. That is a quotation from the opening statement of Harvard economic professor Claudia Golden, her paper that she did in 2006 on the subject of the gender college gap. She goes on to note that male enrollments began to increase in the 1930s and accelerated in the 1940s as returning servicemen entered college on the GI Bill. The high point of gender imbalance in college enrollment occurred in 1947. That was the year of peak imbalance where there were more men than women. That's the year in which there were so many more men than women. That was the peak year, was 1947. But starting from that point, female college enrollments have been increasing relative to male enrollments until now, as you guys probably have noticed from walking around the campus, women outnumber men on most college campuses, in most majors, and indeed in many, many professional programs as well. So there is no college enrollment gap anymore. And note the starting point of that trend that Claudia Golden notes, 1947, a full decade and a half prior to the founding of the National Organization of Women and prior to the publication of the Feminine Mystique. These trends were in place well before the feminist movement ever appeared on the scene. Women were already, in a sense, doing what they were calling for. They were going to college. Same thing if we look at the trend of women's participation, married women's participation in the labor force. That also began well before the feminist movement. Labor force participation began to increase around the turn of the 20th century, and it accelerated into the 1940s. Contrary to most of the popular myths, not every Rosie the Riveter went home immediately after the armistice, okay? So a large percentage of women workers actually did continue to work after the war, and in fact, the acceleration in married women's labor force participation is so strong in the 1940s that economic historians don't debate whether there was an acceleration in their labor force participation. They just debate why. What was the reason why it took place in the 40s? Why you all of a sudden saw an acceleration of the trend of married women participating in the labor force? And again, feminist ideology is not and cannot be the primary cause of a shift that took place in the 1940s. So what is it that took place in the 1960s? Well, I believe what happened is that a group of Marxist women hijacked these trends and steered them into a very particular direction. And I have a couple of quotations from Marx and Engels that I would like to just share with you, just so you kind of see the background to this thing. Because Marxism, I think, contributed a couple of big ideas to that movement, to the feminist movement. The first is that relationships between men and women are necessarily characterized by conflict. Okay? That is, that there's a continual danger of the dominance of men over women. And the corollary to that is that men can't be trusted. An intelligent woman takes care of herself financially and emotionally. Marriage is an institution that oppresses women, and therefore anyone should be permitted to leave a marriage for any reason or no reason. This is part of that whole way of viewing the relationship between men and women. The second idea that came from Marxism is that sex and gender are not primarily biological categories or physical categories. It's not something that has to do with the body or some ontology of the human person, that in fact sex and gender are primarily political categories. They're socially constructed, and not only are they socially constructed, but they're primarily political. And any observed differences between men and women are automatically suspect. And if men and women are not equally represented in all fields of endeavor, then the government needs to do something to rectify that injustice. In fact, you could say that what we got kind of took from that period of time was the idea that gender is almost a cosmic injustice of some sort, and that it's necessary to repair that injustice or do something about it, as opposed to the idea that gender is just something embedded in nature that we need to deal with, and that there are a variety, we have choices about how to deal with it, obviously, but that there is a fundamental reality there that needs to be dealt with. Now, this particular type of feminism, I'm going to reveal my age here now because, you know, so this puts me in the fuddy-duddy caucus here, but, you know, this particular type of feminism gave us women permission for certain kinds of things, right? It gave us basically an inexhaustible supply of permission slips to nag our husbands about why they weren't doing enough around the house. And most of us don't actually need permission slips to nag our husbands. Most of us do that just fine without any coaxing. And feminism also, that kind of feminism, also tacitly told us what kind of person to seek as a husband. What are you looking for in a husband? Well, you're looking for somebody who will do half the housework and not bother you too much when it comes time for your career. That's basically what you're looking for. And those ideas, which I know perfectly well, there are many styles of feminism, lots of arguments amongst feminism. I'm sure I'm not doing them all justice, you know. But that, I believe it's safe to say, is what filtered into the culture, right, is these ideas of male dominance as a continual threat to women, and the idea of gender as being something that's more political than it is biological. And I think that we don't have to believe either of those two things. See, we don't need either of those two ideas in order for women to participate in the labor force, in order for women to pursue careers and to pursue higher education. We can throw those ideas under the bus and just be perfectly fine, is the way I would look at it. And that's what I'd like to encourage you to think about. That's where we'll head here. Now, I want to just pause but to draw out that both of these ideas have Marxist origins. And I'm going to just bring you a couple things from Engels and leave it at that, knowing perfectly well that many developments have taken place since then, but life is too short. I have not read it all. You know, so I just want you to understand that this is embedded, and I think you'll recognize it when you read it. When I read it, I had the idea of kind of scales falling off my eyes that now finally I understand what people are trying to say to me. So here's what Engels, as you know, was one of Marx's closest collaborators early on, and he writes of an early, almost mythic period in which group marriage was the norm, and in which group marriage without any concern for the parentage of the children was ordinary. And according to Engels, the transition from group marriage to monogamy marked the beginning of the subordination of women. So I'm going to read you an extensive quotation so that you know I'm not making this up. Here's from Engels. In the old communistic household, which comprised many couples and their children, the task entrusted to women of managing the household was as much a public, a socially necessary industry as the procuring of food by men. With the patriarchal family, and still more with the single monogamous family, a change came. Household management lost its public character. It no longer concerned society. It became a private service. The wife became the head servant, excluded from all participation in public production, and within the family, the husband is the bourgeois, the wife is the proletariat. He explicitly says that. The first condition for the liberation of the wife is to bring the whole female sex back into public industry. This in turn demands that the characteristic of the monogamous family as the economic unit of society be abolished. Close quote. So there you have it. For Marx and Engels and their followers, the relationship between men and women is a special case of class struggle. Sex and gender are fundamentally political categories. Marriage is intrinsically as oppressive as private property. And if you're not convinced of that, just notice a couple of historical facts. And that is that For the Bolsheviks in 1917, one of their first acts was to liberalize divorce laws. And as recently as 2005, when the socialist government took over in Spain, that was one of their first acts, was to liberalize divorce laws. So, and throughout the entire discussion, there's one category of person that's conspicuously absent in all of this struggle between the men and the women. We don't talk about children. Where do these children come from? Viewing sex as a political category distorts the discussion of children. Throughout the discussion here in Engels, at least, the only mention of children is this rather dubious claim that they were somehow all raised by the group. He doesn't mention the biological differences between men and women, mothers and fathers, or the unique contributions that each make to parenting, or the significance of the collaboration between men and women for the rearing of children. The pregnant woman's distinct vulnerability is not even worth mentioning. Now, this is important for us because the issues of children are deeply related to the issues of economics that we started with, okay? That the issue of children and marriage is very wrapped up in the issues of economics. And I would argue that going one step beyond that, the issues of sex itself are deeply wrapped up in all of these things. So let me just say a few words about that, about the connection between marriage, family, children, and work, okay? Economists have known for a long time that the biggest single factor generating the differences in earnings between men and women is babies, children, and marriage in particular. It's been known, it's been in the literature since the late 1960s, it's been in the literature, that never married women earn essentially the same as never married men. Okay, that's been in the literature for a long time. And as things have changed, with greater participation of women in the labor force and so on, there is still a great element of truth to that generalization. What happens is that when men get married, their labor force participation and commitment and effort increases. And that has been substantiated in pathbreaking work by the late, great Stephen Nock here at the University of Virginia in the sociology department, who had a wonderful book called Marriage and Men's Lives, where he goes through and demonstrates the connection between men getting married and men settling down and behaving better. I mean, there's just no other way to put it. A married man, especially when a man becomes a father, they behave better, which is not true when a single man becomes a father. We'll just note parenthetically, though Steve didn't talk about that so much. And yes, he checked for selection bias. It's not just the case that all the good guys get married and the single guys are all losers. He checked that. That's not the case. There's a difference in behavior that takes place, okay? And if you don't believe me, just go look for Marriage and Men's Lives. It's a great book. So marriage accelerates men's participation and productivity and contributions in the workforce. And what happens with women? Women tend to withdraw some of their participation, perhaps all of their participation for a time in the workforce, and channel their energies elsewhere, right? They channel their energies towards the production and rearing of children. And therefore, their earnings go down. Now, I have to pause here and tell you a personal story about myself, since I came of age during the 70s. I graduated from college in 1971, graduated from high school in 1971, graduated from college in 1975, and I knew all these statistics because I was an undergraduate econ major. Already knew way more about economics than the typical feminist. So I knew all this stuff. I knew this data. And so my plan for myself was that I was going to get married. And the marriage part was a little more complicated, but I did get married. My plan for myself, given that I was married, was that I would get tenure. I'd get my doctorate in economics, which, as Karen mentioned, I did that. I got tenure. I was going to get tenure at a major university, and then once I did that, then and only then I would have a baby during the summer, and then I'd put the baby into daycare and go right back to work in the fall. That was my plan for myself. Now, why was I thinking like that? Because the data told me if you step out of the labor market for like 5 minutes, your human capital will go to pieces. You know, that's what will happen to you. So I had it all worked out. This is what I was going to do. And when I was at George Mason, this seemed like a credible plan because I had women friends in the law school and the College of Arts and Sciences who amongst them had probably 10 children, and none of them had ever taken a day off. None of them had ever missed a class. Okay, this was what women did in the 80s. You know, you just get right back in the saddle and ride. Well, imagine my surprise when the baby did not arrive during the month that I had set aside for it. You know, And so my husband and I were confronted with a 4-year infertility crisis, which for me was a crisis, and for most people, infertility is a crisis. But for me, it was a spiritual crisis because it was the first time in my life that I could not get what I wanted by trying harder, working longer, and being smart. I was used to getting what I wanted and controlling the outcomes of my life by trying harder. And, of course, any sensible old wife will tell you, you don't solve an infertility crisis by trying harder. You know, that just doesn't work. So we completely let go of ever having any children after 4 years and conversion and, you know, all kinds of things that went on during that period of time. And so in 1990, we applied to adopt from Romania. And we put in our adoption paperwork around Thanksgiving of 1990. And this was early on. Berlin Wall had just fallen. This was all kind of new and exciting and everything. So we get a call in January of 1991 saying, we have a little boy for you. He'll be 2.5 when you get him. We know his name, his age, his birthday. He's described as being in good health. What do you say? And we said, sure, why not? And then 10 days later, I went to the doctor with a head cold and found out I was pregnant. So we had 2 children in 6 months' time, which is a record even for a Catholic to do it that fast. So what that did to us was, for me as a as an economist, I promise you, I was not prepared for what we were dealing with here. You know, with this little guy who had been badly neglected in an orphanage, and you know, then a little baby. And my husband, if anything was if it's possible, was even less prepared. My husband's an engineer. And so the two of us were here, a pair of nerds, basically, with these 2 kids in our home. And naturally, a pair of nerds, we look at these 2 kids, and what do we see? We see a controlled experiment. And the controlled experiment is, what difference does it make whether you have a mom and dad in your life? What difference does it make? Well, it turns out, of course, it makes a huge difference. Because our little guy, who had been basically in a crib by himself in a room full of other cribs, had profound difficulties owing to the lack of human personal contact. So my plan of popping him in daycare so that I could go back on the back in the labor force, that plan went right out the window, right? Because he didn't need institutional care. He'd had plenty of institutional care. What he needed was mommy. What he needed was a mom. He needed a person. He needed a relationship. That's what he needed. And that would be me, right? That was not something I could farm out to somebody else. It's something that had to happen on a one-to-one basis. Because that's what it was about. That's what was lacking in his life. So the moral of that story is that even with the idea that women can and should participate, and even with the great feminist idea that everybody should have access to all daycare all the time as much as they want, you cannot go into your adult life with the idea that all of your kids will be fine in daycare. See, you might be able to put all your kids in daycare. That might, you know, you might have kids for whom that's fine. But then again, you might not, right? You might have a kid that is not going to do well in daycare for whatever reason. My reason is kind of an outlier, right? I admit my reason's extreme. But on the other hand, it's not all that uncommon for parents to have their kids look at how they're doing and go, this is not working. We got to do something else. So what does all of that tell us? It tells us that the woman's withdrawal from the labor force does have economic consequences to her, but that what she's doing outside the labor force is socially constructive, right? It's extraordinarily valuable, important, it's personally gratifying and rewarding. And I think you can see that leaving the labor force, even for 10 years as I did, that your brain doesn't completely turn to mush. I hope you can see that. Well, maybe I'm acting like a mush brain, but I don't think so. You know, we have this idea, you know, that you're going to die if you leave the labor force. All right. So this is one of the things that was given to us by this whole brand of Marxist feminism. And so this is where the economics and the social overlap and come together. Right now, where we are within the culture is that the whole society has been built up around a particular model of women participating in the labor force. And that particular model is the one that I had in the back of my mind when I thought to myself, well, I'll get back to work just as soon as I possibly can. A lot of people have that model in their mind in one way or another. And in a sense, the law has progressed along those lines, hasn't it, to make it possible for women to participate in the labor force on the same terms as men all the time, right? So that you can leave the labor force for as short a period as possible and get right back in there and have your job exactly waiting for you. That's the way it's set up, so that you're supposed to leave for 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever it is. What is that doing? Yes, it's a great benefit to parents. But on the other hand, it's also saying, in 8 weeks, you need to be back. That's what it's creating. And I think a lot of you are familiar with the kinds of pressures that that puts on you. The other part of the thing is that it's now become the norm for educated people that both people work, that the mother and the father both work. Look at the housing market. The housing market is built on the assumption that people who move into neighborhoods with good schools have two incomes to pay for the mortgage. That's the assumption built into the economy itself. And all of you know, who have professional aspirations, who have career aspirations, you know that the way this labor market is set up is that you are supposed to get on that track. You come in as a freshman. You finish in 4 years. You go to graduate school or professional school. You get done, you get your first clerkship, you get your first job, you make partner, and if you don't make partner, you might as well slit your wrist because you're done. Am I right? Okay. In academics, I never did law school, but I did a PhD school. Same deal. If you don't make tenure at a great university, you might as well jump off a cliff because you're obviously an idiot. You know? I mean, that's the way you're treated. Now, what's the problem with that model? First of all, it's not typical of the rest of the economy, I'm here to tell you. Those of you who've been in higher education your whole life, you need to know that not everybody has lifetime jobs like we do. The tenure thing, the partner thing. Once you're in for good. Most people don't have jobs like that, just so you know. So it's not a typical career path. But it is the career path of the people who are most influential in making public policy, academics and lawyers, right? Okay, there are very strong voices in the public square saying, here's what women need, here's what society needs, yada, yada, yada. This is this up or out promotion career ladder. That's what they have in the back of their mind. Public policy has been built on that. So that if you're going to create public policy, you have it in your mind. You don't want people to leave the labor force. You don't want them to leave. You need to keep them in there so that they can get those good jobs. And that becomes the focus. If you're trying to help women, the way you help them is keep them in there. Second problem with it is that it's built around the career paths and the needs of people who don't give birth. That would typically be men. Okay, but in this case, not always men. This is a male career path. Why do I say it's a male career path? Because all of your investment in your career is stacked up in the beginning of your career. Right? You do all your on-the-job training in your 20s, all packed up right at the front. And then you're supposed to live off that capital for the rest of your life. You know, you have this huge spike in your earnings. I'm drawing, for the you who are listening in on the MP3 file, I'm drawing a little graph here. You leap up, you get this huge increase in your earnings. I know you're all looking forward to that so you can pay off your student loans. And then it kind of flattens out and it stays there. Okay? Now, what's wrong with this picture that I just drew in the air with my finger? What's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with this picture is that if you're a woman who has family aspirations, who would like to have a child, this just happens to be the same time when your body is the most ready to be doing that. When every fiber of your body wants to have a baby. And I'm sorry if this offends some of our feminist sisters who may be listening in. This is another feature of some forms of feminism that we weren't supposed to pay attention to the fact that we like this and want this and so on and so forth. But let's face it, part of the biological reality is that we want this. Right? We want to have babies. We want to take care of our babies. And that just happens to be going on at the exact same time when you're supposed to be finishing your law degree and making partner. Okay, so what's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with this picture is that we settled for too little in the feminist movement. That early brand of feminism settled for too little. Here's what we settled for. We said, we want to participate in the labor force. And we agree to participate in the labor force. We agree to chemically neuter ourselves during our peak childbearing years so that we can participate. And if we have any children, that is, if we're lucky enough to have any children, we agree to put them in daycare so that we can participate. So what we agreed to was that we agreed to be men in skirts. That's basically what we agreed to. And we've been calling this feminism. Okay, this is what women, this is the bargain that we've made, that we get to participate as long as we do these things. In effect, what we've done is we've said we're going to take the economic system and the career ladder is given, and we're going to adapt our bodies to the career ladder. Because, by the way, what happens to us now that we've put our bodies through the, you know, kind of trauma of being sexually active without having children, and there's a number of physiological problems with doing that? What happens when you finally do want to have a child and your fertility's been impaired just because of old age? I mean, 30 is old age, 35 is really old age, 38 is totally old age. That's when I had my first child, my only child, my only live birth. What happens? What do we do then? Then we get into artificial reproductive technology, which is a real assault on the body. You know, if you look at what women go through to have a baby in their 40s, there's a lot of unnatural, difficult, painful things that women put themselves through. That's part of the bargain that we've made under the influence of this form of feminism. So what I would say to us, what the alternative to feminism is we embrace our fertility. We embrace the fact that we're women. We start from the beginning and we say, look, if this is a goal of mine, and I understand not everybody has this as their goal, I understand that, but if this is a goal of yours, to take it seriously, to plan for it, to go for it in some way. And how do you do that? Well, you do it through cooperation with the child's father, right? You do it through lifelong cooperation with the child's father, which is that you make an agreement that you're together, to work together for the good of your children, your common child. And by the way, if you don't start until you're 38, you're not going to have very many kids. You're going to have an only child. You know what I'm saying? If you start in your 20s, it's possible that your children could have siblings, which is kind of a nice thing, you know, to have siblings. Anyway, that's a parenthetical side. Not everybody shares those views or values or feelings. But, you know, just so you know, if you don't start till 35, you're not having 10 kids. Okay, so if you have these fantasies in your mind, which I kind of did, you know, go figure. I had a degree in economics. I was supposed to be able to do this kind of basic math, but, you know, sorry. We kid ourselves on multiple levels about these things, don't we? So you collaborate with your child's father. And you go ahead and you leave the labor force, understanding that you will come back later, that you have the opportunity to come back later. And what gives you the opportunity to come back later? Because you and your child's father are working together as a team, where he helps you, and then you help him. That you both understand that you together are collaborating to produce something of value, which is to say someone of value, right? And you're investing in your children. You're investing in the future of your culture, the future of your society. You're working together. And when the kids are a little bit older, you can go back. You know, remember that little picture I drew? That little age earnings profile? Nothing economically bad would happen if you just picked that whole distribution up and moved it over 10 or 15 years. So if you enter the labor force at 35 with a law degree or 40 with a law degree, there's no reason you can't recapture all of your investment. You've got plenty of years of working life left that you could recapture that. But what does that require? It requires that the labor force adapt to us, that the labor force accept the fact that women want to have children, and that you're not an idiot if you come to the labor force at the age of 40, and that if you want to leave for part-time, that that's something that firms and companies should be working with us on. And how will they work with us? If we demand it. Only if we demand it. If we settle for the current model, that the current model is what we will get. So I believe that the new women's movement should take this form, should take the form of collaboration with the spouse. And let's now name what we're talking about. We're talking about marriage. We're not talking about just a nice little buddy-buddy agreement that we make with some guy that we pick up. We're talking about lifelong married love for the good of the children, for the good of the two of us, that we can meet our goals as a team better together than we can if we're each trying to go it alone. Because let's be honest, what a lot of women have ended up doing is raising their children alone and spending larger and larger parts of their lives alone. This was not necessarily what we were after with the feminist movement. That what we can do, what is possible for us, is to create that collaboration between men and women, rather than focusing on the conflict, as Marxism taught us to do. Rather than seeing the differences between men and women as a source of conflict, we can see the differences as a source of collaboration, as opportunities, as we would say in economics, for gains from trade. That there are possible ways that we can build one another up through our very differences. That this is possible to us. Now, it requires a difference in mentality by women, that we ask for something different, but it also, I think you can see, requires a different approach to the law. That the goal of feminism is no longer to create identical career paths for men and women. That should not be the goal of legislation or legal judicial interpretation and so on. That should not be the goal. The goal should be to have the labor market as flexible as you can possibly make it, so that families can work with their employers to work out what's going to be the most effective for them. Because there isn't one model that fits everybody. There isn't. There shouldn't be. We shouldn't be looking for one. What we should be doing is allowing companies and individuals and families to work it out amongst themselves. And that means relaxing certain types of restrictions. In California, for example, we had the opportunity, there was a movement probably about 10 years back, because it was about when we first went to California, there was a movement, this was in the heyday of Silicon Valley, before any one of their bubbles had burst. And so Silicon Valley was going great guns, and there was a proposal that had nothing to do with women, but it's germane, you'll see it's germane to women. The proposal was to change the hours legislation, the hours of work legislation, so that you could work 40 hours per week without being charged overtime, without charging your employer overtime, but you could work those 40 hours a week on 4 days. So you could have 4 10-hour days rather than 5 8-hour days. Why did the people in Silicon Valley wanted that? They wanted it because of traffic. That was 1 day less in traffic, okay? So there's no ideological thing going here. You see what I'm saying? This is as neutral, as safe as you could hope for. And the union shot it down, okay? The unions like their 40-hour, 5-day-a-week, they like those kind of rules. They did not want to relax that kind of rule, okay? So that kind of thinking that says the way to protect workers is, by golly, this one and only thing, there's something wrong with that way of thinking, and we need to move beyond that way of thinking to go for more flexibility, both over the life cycle and within time, within a period of time. These, it seems to me, are the main ways that we can move forward for a new alternative vision of feminism, an alternative vision that embraces the reality of differences between men and women and that allows us to live with those differences in a way that is collaborative and cooperative and supportive of men and women alike. And I'll stop now and take questions, because I know there are always questions and comments after a talk like this. So thank you very much.